All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true.
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
This episode is brought to you by Aspire Healthy Energy. Find them at AspireDrinks.com. If you're like me, you want energy that actually feels good without the sugar crash or the jittery buzz that comes with most energy drinks. That's why I love Aspire. With 80 milligrams of natural caffeine from green tea and guarana, about half the caffeine of most leading energy drinks, Aspire delivers smooth, steady energy that lasts. No jitters, no crashes. Plus, it's zero sugar and zero calories, and packed with B and C vitamins, biotin, and ginger to support your focus and metabolism. The flavors are seriously good. Mango, lemonade, raspberry, sweet cherry. You'll actually look forward to cracking one open. And here's the best part. I've arranged an exclusive deal for my listeners. You get 20% off your entire order. This is the highest discount out there, and you cannot find it anywhere else. Just go to AspireEnergyDrinks.com and use my promo code ZEROSIGNAL at checkout, or click the link in the show notes where the discount is applied automatically. That's AspireDrinks.com. Promo code ZEROSIGNAL. Fuel your day the healthier way.
You're tuned into Zero Signal, a show about what they won't say and what you're probably already thinking. No fluff, no filters, no bullshit. Let's crack it open.
At this time, I'm going to ask you to fasten your seatbelts.
The Grand Canyon. It's more than just a crack in the earth. It's a place that almost demands mystery. Standing on the rim, you're staring into a chasm so vast and layered, it feels like another world. Caves line its walls by the hundreds. Dark mouths and the public will never see. The Park Service keeps them sealed to protect fragile ecosystems, ancient artifacts, and even endangered bats. That's the official story. But when you close off doorways into the unknown, people start asking, what else are they hiding in there? And then there are the names. Isis Temple, Cheops Pyramid, Tower of Ra. Not nicknames from the modern conspiracy forums, but official place names given more than a century ago by a geologist with a taste for the mythology. To the average hiker, they're just about labels on a map. To the conspiracy-minded, they're breadcrumbs, evidence that something ancient and foreign once lived here. Even the sky above plays into the myth-making. Airspace above the canyon is restricted, and when you combine no-fly zones with off-limit caves and secretive archaeology, you create the perfect recipe for the government cover-ups and hidden civilizations. That's why the Grand Canyon is such a fertile ground for conspiracy. It's not just stone and river. It's a canvas for every theory you can imagine. Ancient Egyptians carving tombs into the cliffs. Giants buried in sealed caves. Underground tunnels that connect to civilizations beneath our feet. Some of these claims can be debunked in a heartbeat. Others, well, they'll make you pause. And that's why we're here today, to pull back the layers of rumor and reality to see what's truly hiding in that giant canyon. So, Jay, what do you make of this conspiracy?
I really like this conspiracy theory, and I'm inclined to believe a lot of the proposed evidence, a lot of the proposed theories that kind of revolve around it. I think it's a fun one, man, and it's been getting a lot of attention lately. It links back to the Smithsonian's and some of these articles back in the early 1900s. So the genesis of this one, at least in terms of the westernized American awareness, starts with a fella by the name of G.E. Kincaid. Have you heard anything about him?
Yeah, there's a lot of writings about G.E. Kincaid.
Yeah. Interesting fella. Maybe you know more of his backstory than I do, but essentially there's an article published back in April 1508, and he was looking for minerals down through the Grand Canyon. Put the backdrop in the story, Teddy Roosevelt decided to limit access to the Grand Canyon in hopes of preserving it. So essentially what he wanted to do was to prevent mining operations and deforesting operations. The deforesting operations doesn't make a whole lot of sense because there's not a lot of trees out there. It's not like there's timber. But essentially what he was trying to do is keep people from mining gold down in the Grand Canyon. But before all that took effect, G. Kincaid went down there looking for minerals. And I think minerals is a term for gold before the restrictions took place. So as he's going down through the canyon, down one of the rivers, he sees what he thinks is like a mineral deposit. It's about 2,000 feet above the rock face, and he decides to go ahead and hike up in there. So when he gets there, he sees a cave entrance. And when he walks the cave, he purported to see Egyptian hieroglyphics, mummies of both regular-sized humans and giant humans. And he said this cavern traveled miles and miles and miles. It was so big, it was reported that it could actually house 50,000 people. So, interesting story published in a mainstream newspaper at the time. Apparently, there's photos, but a lot of those were either taken back to the Smithsonian's along with a ton of the artifacts. And it gets to an interesting twist. So when he's down there, he's actually exploring this area with the funding of the Smithsonian's. So he goes back and reports to them what he found. They send roughly 30 to 40 Smithsonian archaeologists under the lead of S.A. Jordan, and they report the same thing. They found hundreds of chambers, all full of not only Egyptian artifacts, but also some Eastern artifacts. They purported to find a statue of Buddha, along with the mummies, and all kinds of gold-endowed statues, and just the typical stuff you would see in any sort of Egyptian museum.
Yeah, just to level set a little bit back, so G.E. Kincaid's story originates around April of 1909, and the newspaper that you referenced was the Arizona Gazette, which is a small Phoenix newspaper, published this sensational article. In it, they name Kincaid and claim he discovered this massive cavern system while traveling down the Colorado River. They don't make it like if he was going out there to discover it or just perhaps taking an expedition down the Grand Canyon and runs into it. But the cave he discovers wasn't just any cave. According to the story, it held mummies wrapped in cloth, statues and copper weapons, mysterious hieroglyphs, and entire chambers carved into the rock. It was described as this subterranean city and an ancient world really frozen in time. The article went even further. Supposedly, this Smithsonian archaeologist named Professor S.A. Jordan arrived to lead an excavation. The story suggested that the Smithsonian had quietly taken control and cataloged the artifacts, and then sealed off the cave so nobody else could get there. After that, silence. No reports, no artifacts ever displayed, no coordinates to prove the site existed. This is where, in my opinion, the conspiracy really takes root. If the Smithsonian didn't find ancient Egyptian or Asian presence in North America, why the hell would they hide it? It's not because such a discovery would rewrite history, challenging the mainstream archaeology and upsetting the powerful institutions. To this day, the internet forums and YouTube documentaries keep the legend alive, pointing to the canyon, the Egyptian-sounding landmarks, Isis Temple, Cheops Pyramid, Tower of Ra, as proof that something was going on there. For me, when I dig into the facts, the cracks do appear a little bit. The Smithsonian has publicly stated that there's no record of G.E. Kincaid, and let's be frank, if they're trying to hide something, they would probably hide his name. They also said there's no Professor Jordan and no expedition into the canyon that occurred in 1909. Researchers like Don Lego, respected Grand Canyon historian, really have combed through the Smithsonian archives and the Arizona Gazette's publication history and other period newspapers. What they found is that 1909 piece fits neatly into a broader pattern of the earliest 20th century lost civilizations newspaper stories that were going around during that time. Articles meant more to sell papers rather than report facts. These hoaxes were common at the time, playing into the American appetite for adventure tales and exotic discoveries and these kind of archaeological mysteries. The story refuses to die, and I understand why. Because if they discovered something really important there, as G.E. Kincaid reportedly did, even though the Smithsonian is trying to cover it up, what's the purpose behind it? Perhaps they're trying to say that the official narrative that our education system likes to feed us, that evolution is the mainstream, perhaps they discover something more important. Perhaps they discovered something that speaks to the Christian narrative of creation and Noah's flood. And that's what I go back to. What are they trying to hide? Because there's a lot of miraculous discoveries that were discovered during Kincaid's time there, along with others that we see along the route. So it's a really fascinating story, but for me to find this person actually existed, it was pretty hard to find that fact.
Yeah, I mean, I think the further you go back in time, especially in the early 1900s, all those records are written. And it doesn't take a whole lot of effort to find the written record and pull it from your file cabinet. It's so much easier to make somebody disappear and to remove an expedition from your files than it would be today. Everyone today has phones, there's internet, information flies back and forth in milliseconds. Back then, I'm sure there are plenty of people that have some fantastic stories that we'll never know about because it's their hand journals that either waste away the time, got burned up in the fire. You know the story of the Library of Alexandria, the halls and halls of records from antiquity that was burnt by the Romans. There's a ton of information there that was transcribed onto scrolls or into parchment, and it's not a whole lot different than it would be back in 1909. It's easy to make those records disappear. I'm also under the impression and under the belief that the Smithsonian Institute hides a lot of archaeological facts from us that don't meet the mainstream educational narrative. So for me, it's not a far-fetched claim to remove these records and to claim the expedition never existed. And the people telling us this, all they're doing is referencing what they can find. And they're just drawing the conclusion. It's not that they're trying to deceive us. They're just saying there's no records exist and we can't find any evidence of the such. Just like if you were a cop and you're looking into a case that happened back in 1945 and somebody came to you and said, hey, I know this person was murdered. But if you go into the files, someone took the file out, you're not going to know any different. It's like that never happened, or at least we don't have any record of it happening.
Yeah. It's a good point. A lot of time has passed since this expedition has occurred, and people hide facts. Have you heard about the giant skeletons that were discovered in this region?
Yeah, I did run across some of that. A lot of giant mummified skeletons that were pulled out of the caves. And the claim there, too, is that they were hauled off to the Smithsonian's. And again, we go back to this claim that there's huge underground vaults underneath it that house a plethora of archaeological evidence that don't fit the mainstream. I often think about Indiana Jones. He's in these underground bunkers, just full of this archaeological archive that nobody knows exists. And that sometimes I think, and we've talked about it before, that media reflects some of the secrets in society in general.
Yeah, and one of the kinds I think about, and we'll circle back to this a little bit later, when we talk about the giant skeletons, is I think about the Nephilim. But we'll circle back to the religious topic a little bit later. But to give some background, and what this is going to serve is the greater Smithsonian narrative. Because everything you look at, they want to debunk immediately. So I'm not saying I believe this, but this is the information that I found. And it's in regards to one of the legends of the Grand Canyon that just refused to die. And really to American archaeology in general, is the claim that these giant human skeletons were once unearthed here and then quietly destroyed by the Smithsonian. It sounds like something, as you stated, out of Indiana Jones. Explorers hauling these enormous bones out of cavernous tombs, only for them to vanish in government vaults and never really being seen again. The version most people see online today actually traces back to an article published in 2014. It claimed that the Smithsonian admitted to destroying tens of thousands of giant skeletons in the early 1900s, right around Kincaid when he discovered it in 1908. They say that the story was fiction, but obviously, when you're talking about giant skeletons, it spreads like wildfire across all of your social media platforms, Facebook, YouTube, and obviously your conspiracy forums, kind of stripped of that satire, which is the narrative that's Smithsonian wants to tell people. But obviously, a lot of people want it to be true. But honestly, the Giant's ideal didn't start in 2014. It was much older than that, stretching back to the 19th century. Newspapers of that era routinely published these tales of giant skeletons discovered in Native American burial mounds, often with no verification whatsoever. Some of these reports may have been deliberate hoaxes, otherwise likely come from the farmers or amateur diggers, misidentifying the bones of Macedonians or what they call the Macedonians or the Ice Age megafauna as human remains, and then kind of radicalized as mound builder myths of that time. And, you know, that false ideal that an ancient lost race built North America's great earthworks instead of the indigenous people, and you had these fertile soil of the giant narrative kind of grow. And now the Smithsonian role was to serve the greater narrative. All of this stuff is fake. Don't listen to any of it. Of course, we have records dating back to 1600 or whatever, and they're hiding it. But it seems a little bit weird that we see this repetitive news article coming out where they're hauling these giant skeletons out of the Grand Canyon. I think what we do know is that the Grand Canyon is very old. And that's your definition of how old the Earth is, whatever you want to put that to. But it's obviously been there a really long time, and it's served like our history of the world that's always been there. So I don't buy the history they're trying to sell us here. It seems a little bit unusual to me that many people are documenting it. It pops up during Kincaid's discovery of 1908, and then it later pops back up here in the 20th century.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of some ancient Native American legends, myths, stories about them actually fighting giants. There's stories, especially when the further west you go, the more detailed and numerous they become. But the natives had stories about giants running across the plains, and they were so big, they could run faster than buffalo, grabbing them with one hand and run off with them. That's a big freaking giant, big and strong. They're running faster than the herds. They're able to pick one up in each hand and those waves. What, 1,200 pounds? And scary stuff. And there's plenty of stories, especially going back into the late 1800s, late 1900s, by farmers saying that they found giant bones on their property. They inform the local government, which in turn informs the federal government, which ultimately traces back to the Smithsonian. And they come out, they excavate the bones, and then they're never heard from again. And do I think that they destroyed these giant bones?
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Bones, I don't. I think that if they exist, which I'm inclined to believe that they do, they're warehoused somewhere underground. I don't think everything is housed underneath the Smithsonian's. I've been there before. You've been there before. That complex would have to be ginormous. But I think there are places around the U.S. where they house some of this archaeological stuff that's out of sight, out of mind. There's also stories of the like conquistadors landing on certain islands, being met by the indigenous that are 7, 8, 9 feet tall. And typically, most of the time, they were pretty passive, but it was intimidating enough for them to get back on their boats and get the heck out of town.
It kind of reminds me, and this is post-flood, and we talk about Numbers 11, and don't quote me word for word on this. It ultimately ended up being the Israelis as they were invading a territory. They were very scared. And what they said was the men were giants and we were like crickets to them. They were so big that we looked like crickets to them and they looked like to us. So it tells you that Nephilim survived post-flood and they were within our world. And these bones might actually back it up. And I think a lot of the world is trying to cover up the narrative of God and hide that away. So I could see that they don't want us to learn about that. Now, it talked about some of the myths that they do want us to know about. So I actually got this off of one of the sites associated with the Smithsonian Institute. And here are a couple of legends that they actually want to tell us about, which they say may or probably not be true. But I thought they were of material kind of interesting value anyways. So one of their first myths is Paul Bunyan's axe created the canyon. You remember Paul Bunyan, the giant axe builder. Now we're talking about giants there. The legendary lumberjack, obviously featured in tales, had a hand in the Grand Canyon's creation. One of the more kind of imaginative myths about the landmark. According to folklore, Bunyan was dragging his massive axe behind him and it gouged out a deep furrow in the earth, eventually becoming the Grand Canyon. While this story adds a touch of kind of whimsy to the canyon's history, its formation was actually due to a lot of different things. The next one was the giant eagle that saved people from the canyon flood. So this is another obviously captivating myth surrounding the Grand Canyon. Comes from the, and I might butcher this name, but the Holapi tribe, which involves a particularly heroic bird and a very large eagle. It was responsible for forming the canyon when melting ice and comet caused a large flood. The eagle flew down and courageously rescued the Holapi tribe before the comet hit the earth, carrying them away and moving them to safety. Next, they said Bigfoot may roam the Grand Canyon. The myth surrounding everyone's favorite Sasquatch, Bigfoot, obviously has fascinating people for many decades. This creature also plays a part in the many myths surrounding the Grand Canyon. Reports of Bigfoot sightings have captured the imagination of visitors and enthusiasts, as eyewitnesses have claimed to see the elusive creature roaming in the canyon. The next one was two gods built the canyon. Another myth about the formation of the Grand Canyon comes from the Havosapi tribe. It tells the story of rival gods, Uchapa and Hakatama, who battled to determine the ruler of the earth. During the battle, Hakatama flooded the entire world. Oh, sounds familiar. Leading to the formation of the canyon. While the flood would have seemingly doomed life on Earth, the Tuchapa put his daughter in a safe place so that she could ensure life would continue after the skirmish. Today, life on Earth thrives, and many visitors to the canyons each year take a picture of this site. The next one was the Egyptians lived in the Grand Canyon. Connection to another culture, one of the most enduring myths. Some people believe that there was Egyptian city beneath. The legend traces back to, obviously, the newspaper article we were talking about with G.E. Kincaid. And the next one they said is, and it's weird how they rounded out with this one, but people have bad luck with canyon objects. Then they said, the belief that removing natural objects from the canyon or stealing cultural relics resulted in bad luck. And this legend asserts that anyone who wrongfully decides to take rocks, fossils, plants, or other objects from the canyon will face misfortune because of their actions. They went so far as to say that people have stolen objects from the canyon, whether it be rocks or something else that they found there, and they end up mailing it back to them because it brought them so much bad luck in their life. So when I look at these stories, what I see is a lot of secular kind of belief systems. We see witchcraft from the bad objects. We see false gods. We see other ways to explain what these giants are. They want to talk about everything else but God and try to explain it in a different way. And then they say some of these things are just for fun. But I find it interesting as they always are steering away from God and steering towards the kind of secular world.
Yeah. I mean, I heard an interesting podcast called Prophecy Watchers. I'm a big fan of this guy. His name's Steve Quayle. If our listeners are curious, just go to stevequayle.com. He's big into the giant theory, relates it back to Genesis 6. Fun theological fact that maybe some of our listeners don't know, but the giants pre-flood were referred to as Nephilim. The giants post-flood were referred to as Raphaim or Gibberim. So it's interesting how they have different monikers pre and post flood. I often wonder, we understand how the giants were formed pre-flood with fallen angels coming down to earth, mating with women, and the offsprings were giants. I often wonder, was there another incursion by fallen angels after the flood, or was somebody carrying some sort of remnants of the DNA in their genetic code that kind of created the offspring? I shy away from that theory because God picked Noah and his family because they were perfect in their generations, which in my mind kind of points to the fact that they were genetically pure. They're Adamites. They weren't corrupted by angelic DNA. So I often wonder, how did the giants come back after the flood? There are some interesting theories that maybe some of them escaped underground because there's underground cities. I don't know if I believe that because God said he destroyed all life on earth with the exception of the humans and animals that were on the ark. I think one of the most interesting facts that I've come across is that 90% of the Grand Canyon is off limits to tourists. They use the excuse that it's for tribal whole religious preservation, natural preservation. There's these sacred sites they don't want people trampling over, but 90% of an area that's ginormous and you can't go down. There have been stories about people going down and then next thing you know, they're in off-limit areas and there's guys in black tactical gear coming down, telling them they gotta get out, helicopters flying over, watching what they're doing. And there are some pretty interesting videos of people flying drones, or there was one that I saw where a guy was, they like hang glide, they jump off the cliffs and they paraglide down the canyons. And in certain parts of his camera, his GoPro, you can see that's very evidently columns and structures carved into the canyon that look very Romanesque, very Egyptians with the ornate columns. Obviously, they're worn down because of weathering and time, but they are there. So I find that super interesting. There's also a fellow back in the 1800s named John Powell, who took numerous photos of the Grand Canyon. This is back when it really wasn't off limits. And again, you can see these structures carved into the rock face that are very ornate, weathered, but ornate. And they look very similar to Egyptian type architecture back from that period. It's mind blowing to see.
Have you heard, and we're talking about this Smithsonian narrative still, but have you heard how these places ironically got their Egyptian names?
I haven't, but I find it a bit bizarre that they're all named after Egyptian gods or Egyptian type areas like Mount Isis and what have you.
Yeah, it's super bizarre. And again, we're going to continue down in the Smithsonian narrative until we debunk it. But when you look at a map of the Grand Canyon, you'll see the names: Isis Temple, Cheops Pyramid, Tower of Ra, and Osiris Temple. To me, to anyone primed for conspiracies, these sound like smoking gun evidence of the ancient Egyptian presence in Arizona. After all, why else would, you know, they name these things this? It just doesn't, why would they name them after like gods and pharaohs? It just doesn't make any sense to me. What the Smithsonian says is the truth is far more down to earth. And they said, honestly, just as fascinating. According to them, these names came from Clarence Dutton, a U.S. Geological Survey geologist in the late 19th century. Dutton wasn't just a scientist, he was also a romantic. He wrote about the Grand Canyon in the most poetic terms, describing the cliffs and buffs as natural cathedrals and monuments. To match the grandeur he saw, he pulled from the myths of the world, Egyptian, Hindu, Norse, even the Arthurian legend. In his landmark 1882 monograph, The Tartaria History of the Grand Canyon District, Dutton christened formations not with dry geological jargon, but with the names carried with cultural weight and mystery. Now, to me, that sounds very convenient. Like, we're seeing in 1908 where we discover an Egyptian cave, and all of a sudden we have very Egyptian names that are coming into play. He called one buff the Isis Temple, not because of Egyptians carved it, because of its massive, serene profile reminded him of the goddess of power and mystery. Cheops Pyramid got its name simply because the buff's flat-topped, steep structure looked vaguely like the Great Pyramid of Giza. Dutton's naming scheme wasn't meant to rewrite history. It was meant to inspire awe. But obviously, here's why the myth caught fire. The names have power. When a visitor or an armchair researcher sees the Tower of Ra on a U.S. map, it feels more than coincidence. And to me, it does too. I think you combine those names with the tales of Kincaid's lost Egyptian caves, and suddenly, the canyon transforms into a puzzle box waiting to be solved. And again, we're building on this narrative that they want to sell us, but it seems awfully convenient.
Yeah, I ran across an interesting theory, a couple of them. So there was a theory that back when Mark Antony and Cleopatra were about to be sacked by the Romans, that they sent their son out to the west with 50,000 scientists, soldiers, ships to send him away so the Romans couldn't get him. So I thought that was an interesting kind of thread back through ancient history, where there's a claim that their son was sent, and they say out west. People draw the conclusion that what that meant was to the Americas, because there is evidence that the Egyptians were seafaring people and were actually able to, it's a bit circumstantial, but the claim is that they were able to circumnavigate the globe with their boats. Putting some puzzle pieces together with this legend, it's possible that a few thousand years ago that there was a pretty big cohort of Egyptians that somehow made it to America. I feel like it'd be really difficult to get all to cross thousands of miles in North America to get to the Grand Canyon, but it's an interesting little tidbit. And the other claim is, you've heard of the lost city of El Dorado, like the Golden City. There are some claims that one of the reasons you can't access a big portion of the Grand Canyon because, in fact, the lost city of El Dorado is actually in the Grand Canyon. And the government doesn't want anyone going down there taking the gold, pilfering it, and selling it on the open market. By doing so, if somebody was able to get their hands on all that gold, it would just completely tank the market. Not to mention destroy all the artifacts if, in fact, it does exist in the canyon.
Yeah, it's interesting, man. We've seen it says sail really far. We talk about the Vikings, how far they sailed. Like, they went from Denmark to Greenland to potentially Canada to the Americas with very primitive boats at that time. They're able to go everywhere the will took them. I look back at the Egyptian culture, and during that time, heavily influenced by the Nephilim, who brought this kind of forbidden technology down to man, and not too far of a stretch of imagination to think that they made it all the way over here. I think it's almost a little bit naive to think that only the Native Americans were here and, you know, what, they came from the caveman and nothing else existed before that. Perhaps they existed here and their time ended before the white man showed up.
Yeah, the Hopi Indians have the legend of the Ant People or the Star People, and they claim that they weren't the first here or the first in North America. They claim that there was another somewhat advanced civilization that lived here long before they ever arrived. And they talk about that some of these people had great civilizations that were not only in North America, but South America. And this is the interesting part to me, that they learned this knowledge from quote unquote Star People. So this old civilization that existed before the Native Americans learned their advanced technology, advanced architecture from Star People. And when I hear the term Star People, I think of fallen angels, because that's who gave humankind a lot of the knowledge that we had after we came out of the garden. A lot of people also say there's Anunnaki artifacts in the Grand Canyon. And to me, Anunnaki, as we all know, is this alien race that comes by on planet X every however many thousands of years. They come down, they do what they do. But I feel like Anunnaki is the secular term, the alien term for fallen angels.
100%. And people just don't know how to describe them. And as we touched on earlier, they survive post-flood. In my opinion, fallen angels slept with women again and produced another off-breed. We saw that when David killed Goliath. I think Goliath was likely a Nephilim of that time as well. So we see the existence of them. Whether they still exist today, I'm not certain. Perhaps they were extinguished when the heroes of the Bible kind of wrote against them and took them out. But perhaps they do. And what we know is evil still exists today. So the fact that they continue to prowl this earth like a lion, much like the devil does today, I don't think it would be unheard of to have more Nephilim around. But you're right. I think the Anunnaki was just a worldly, secular kind of viewpoint for what these creatures ultimately were. Now, when we look at the Grand Canyon, it's a marvel. The Grand Canyon is riddled with caves, literally hundreds, if not thousands of them, tucked into the cliffs and hidden into the side of canyons. Most visitors, most people on Earth, will never really glimpse one. And I think that invisibility is exactly what gives birth to some of our theories. The canyons and caves aren't just isolation of pockets of rock. They're entrances to a vast underground network connecting the entire region. And some even imagine these tunnels leading to buried cities, ancient vaults, or lost civilizations. And in many cases, I've seen where people, they've discovered tribes and different things that were living in the bottom of the canyon. And I think that's what's ultimately fascinating, is regardless of what the Smithsonian is going to tell us, regardless of what our history is going to dictate, there's a whole hell of a lot of history down there that's worth discovering. And these are the places that I always say, Jay, that instead of shooting rockets off the moon, we should be discovering this stuff, man, because it's super fascinating. Actually, tell us the details of what's going on down there instead of hiding it from us.
Yeah, part of me thinks that they don't want us to know, because again, we go back to this Rothschild official education system that the West kind of works under. And we have a very regimented way history is taught. It's very compartmentalized, like the Egyptians were here and that's where they stayed. Like the Europeans were there and that's where they stayed. And Native Americans were here, and there wasn't a whole lot of traversing the globe and intermixing of cultures outside of in certain localized areas like in Asia or Europe. I do think there's evidence to suggest suggest that a lot of these more advanced civilizations did travel far and wide, did have prolonged and protracted interactions with cultures that were thousands and thousands of miles away. And I kind of want to circle back to even the more modern day stories of giants. So I'm sure you heard about this, but in Afghanistan, there have been several purported stories of soldiers coming across giants out in the battlefield. There was one that was pretty popular. And if you look at Afghanistan, it's super mountainous. There's a ton of cave systems, not unlike the Grand Canyon area. And there was one story where I think it was a ranger team went up on patrol. They never were heard from again. So they sent another, I don't know if it was a Marine squadron or another special forces squadron to go track them down. And as they get up this mountain, they see the body parts of soldier gear and they just know they're dead. So as they're approaching the cave entrance, these guys said that they saw like a 10 to 12 foot giant run out, throw a spear, pale one of their buddies. And then in turn, they opened up fire and decapitated this giant. And when they reported it, a helicopter came in, they hooked it up to a cargo netting and flew it out. And there are a handful of stories, even in the modern era, where people run across these giants. A lot of tribes still in certain parts of South Asian island area where they claim that giants still exist, but they live very remotely. A lot of the theories are that most of these giants live in cave systems and they come out to eat. 99 times out of 100, these giants are cannibals. They eat humans. They hunt us at night. I do think in the past that they were much more numerous. They actually had their own societies. I think a big part, when you read the Bible, you brought up the story of Moses and going into the promised land. He sent out the spies to go into Cana. And when they came back, I'm just reading what you already said, they came back and said, these people are huge. We're like grasshoppers to them. And that's actually what set them back out into the wilderness for 40 years because they doubted what God could do. But eventually when they got back to the promised land, Joshua took control. And I think a big part of the Israelites conquering the promised land wasn't necessarily from other humans. It was from either giants or the intermixing of giants and humans. And again, this culture was not only cannibalistic, they were very pagan. They were very evil. They sacrificed their children. And that was, Jews were God's army to eradicate this giant culture from the planet.
It's interesting because if you look at the stories in the Nephilim, they were cannibals and they did eat people, which is interesting how it syncs up with that story that you're telling us now. I don't know, man. It's funny because when we look at the Smithsonian narrative, they want to point to Bigfoot. We know Bigfoot's not a real thing, but they want to point to Bigfoot instead of pointing to Nephilim, which is probably the better answer that we're seeing there. Now, obviously, that's not where all the stories end. Have you heard about the UFO connection to the Grand Canyon?
Please tell me.
The 1950s brought a new kind of story, right? Lights over the canyon, glowing orbs that hovered, darted, and then vanished. In the Cold War moment, when Roswell and Area 51 were already fueling the people's imagination, the Grand Canyon became another suspected UFO hotspot. One tale even claims a researcher, Dr. Elizabeth Carter, led an expedition into a cave where she documented alien-like carvings and picked up strange energy readings. Now, to believers, this was confirmation, not just ancient rituals, but alien contact. And to skeptics, Carter herself may be legendary as the carvings, more myth than history. Now, according to the legend, Carter's team didn't just explore, they experienced. In the cavern, they supposedly discovered text and artifacts describing ways to expand the human consciousness, awaken hidden powers, and even bend physical reality. The cave, they said, pulsed with an energy that magnified meditation, awareness, and psychic sensitivity. Now, was it a suggestion, a hallucination, or the canyon itself amplifying something dormant in the human mind? Don't know. Whatever the case, the story paints the cave that could unlock superhuman potential, which became part of the canyon lore. This is where the story shifts from the strange to the cosmic. Deeper still, Carter's team claimed to find a machine, an impossible device of gears, glowing crystals, and humming energy. To her, she said its function was to bend time itself. Inside the cavern, time slowed, stretched, and according to her, looped. The researchers reported glimpses of the past and then visions of the future. Some even claimed hours outside past is only minutes inside this cave. Now, whether fantasy or allegory, the tell plays kind of into humanity's oldest fascinations of controlling time itself. The explorers, it said, encountered an energy being, a guardian of this canyon, who revealed to them humanity's true single purpose. not just to survive, but to evolve into a consciousness that contributes to the cosmos itself. Every thought, every act, it said, ripples outward into the universe. Now, for Carter and her team, this encounter reshaped everything they thought they knew about life, destiny, and the canyon's hidden role, and ultimately our human story. The legend ends with Carter and her team keeping the cavern's discoveries top secret, guarding them until humanity was ready to receive them. Whether now she or the cavern ever existed is another matter. There's no artifacts that I could find, no scientific papers, no independently verified accounts. But this story lives on, and it's retold and remixed and reimagined, which I find super interesting because we're seeing these lights, we're seeing UFOs going on a time that's fairly hotly contested with Area 51 and people seeing these things out there. And then you have this person who, again, is unverified that goes into this. And we're once again, it feels like we're talking about Blue Beam or Project Invisibility, but we're talking about time travel again.
The first thing that comes to mind when I hear that story, so two things come to mind. First one is I do believe that pre-flood, there was advanced technology that is completely different than today, but ultimately very similar. It just looks different in how it's presented visually and what it's made of. Second one comes to mind is whenever I hear of someone saying that our purpose is to evolve into the cosmos, again, now we're not pointing to God and his purpose for us, but we're pointing to some sort of cosmic elite or cosmic cabal that says it's time for us to evolve and ascend and join this galactic federation. So that always raises a red flag to me. That just feels like a satanic deception where it just drives me nuts, man. It's whenever you hear someone saying, I talked to an angel told me this is the true interpretation of the Bible, or I'm adding to the message, my radar starts to ping and head starts to catch on fire. But if there was and there's been plenty of stories about them finding some ancient technology in these caves, just like in Antarctica, people say that there's ancient technology that was found. The Grand Canyon, ancient technology that's found. I just think if it was found, if it is there, it is stuff that happened before God flooded the world. And now we're, as we advance and as we grow more numerous in population and as we're able to traverse and explore the planets, we have a higher likelihood of finding this stuff. And it all seems it's interconnected. If you start drawing lines on the chalkboard or putting string on a corkboard, everything kind of points back to this pre-flood world that existed and the technology that we're starting to stumble across. We're conflating that with aliens and not giving its due respect as to what it actually was.
Yeah, it speaks a lot to me to deception. Deception can be on a grand scale where you're talking about like cosmic and all this kind of weird witchcraft stuff, or it could be on a very small scale. Did you hear about the preacher in Africa that tried to convince the world that Jesus was coming back on September 3rd? And thousands of people gathered in this forest because they thought Christ was coming back and that they were going to be raptured, only to find out the guy was full of it. And when you talk about these preachers, obviously he's a false prophet. He probably believes in God. At least hopefully he believes in God and Jesus. If you read the Bible, Jesus himself said, nobody knows the day, time, or hour. I think he even said, I don't know the day, time, or hour. So clearly this preacher's not going to know. Yeah, only the Father knows. So clearly if you're reading your Bible, this guy's a false prophet, but it's such a small scale deception because he's preaching every week. He's talking about Jesus and God, but he twisted a little bit. And I don't know if he was making money off of it or what his case was for it. He said he actually had a conversation with God and God told him, but God would not rewrite his perfect word in the Bible.
And God doesn't lie.
Exactly.
God's not going to tell you something that's wrong.
Exactly. So when we talk about these things, to me, it's about deception. And then obviously the devil's roaming the world like a prowling lion. And deception is his game. Lying is his game. And influence is his game. But sometimes we see political figures that want to deceive you for their own ends and purposes. And now, there are a couple of things at the Grand Canyon where the government would want to lead you away from. So I think it's a good point to talk about uranium mining. Uranium might sound just like another dry mining term, but around the Grand Canyon, it became one of the most potent lightning rods of controversy. The uranium conspiracy isn't total fantasy. There's a legitimate mining history there. Real political friction and genuine concerns about groundwater and sacred sites. Here's what I found out. The Grand Canyon has had a mine within its own borders, which was called the Orphan Mine, located on the south rim between the Maricopa Point and the Hermit Road. The claim was originally patented in 1906 by a guy named Daniel Hogan. In the early to mid 20th century, miners worked the site selectively for copper and other materials. By 1951, geologists discovered significant uranium deposits planets in the same zone. By 1956, uranium production began in earnest in the Orphan Point. Over the years of active operation until about 1969, estimates suggest the mine produced on the order of about 500,000 tons of ore, yielding about 4.5 million pounds of uranium oxide. Even though the mine's headframe is gone now, many structures have been removed. Contamination remains in the soils and below the surface. And NPS has done remedial cleanup and site investigations. I think the last one was in 2016 to understand the residual radiation and metals in the soil. That's a big thing, and that's part of the whole atom bomb. So I could see why the government would want to steer people away from this site, because there's a whole lot of materials that people really shouldn't be getting their hands on. And then we talk about the Roosevelt connection to the canyon. Teddy Roosevelt visited the Grand Canyon in 1903, right before it became a national park. At that time, mining, ranching, logging interests were really carving into the canyon's resources, and there was little regulation to really stop those people. Roosevelt, already known as a passionate naturalist and conservatist, was struck by the canyon's scale and majesty. He just loved this place. He called it one of the greatest sights every American should see before they die. During that trip, he gave a famous speech at the South Rim where he urged Americans to preserve the canyon in its natural state. His words were pretty powerful. Leave it as it is. You cannot improve upon it. The ages have been at work on it, and men can only mess it up. That sentiment became one of the most quoted lines in American history. At that time of Roosevelt's visit, the Grand Canyon was not yet a national park. The movement to protect it was very controversial, and powerful business interests wanted access to the minerals and timber that were there. But ultimately, Roosevelt got his way, and in 1906, he signed the Antiquities Act, which gave presidents the authority to designate national monuments. And by 1908, using the power of his presidency, Roosevelt proclaimed the Grand Canyon a national monument and pretty much protected the entire thing. And I think this was the kind of the turning point where, although it yet wasn't a national park, Roosevelt's action effectively put the canyon off limits to all commercial business. So we see it right around this time when discoveries are happening that everybody's vying in for control. Everybody wants to mine it. They want to find these valuable resources. Some of them are very dangerous. And the president, who is a naturalist, doesn't want anybody there. He wants to preserve it, which I find a little bit interesting. Now, why did he want to preserve it? I don't know if he was a man of pure beauty. I can never really trust the presidents that we have sitting in office. Maybe, perhaps, he had ulterior motives, but there was a lot of power struggles going on during this time of Kincaid's exploration, during the presidency, during the businesses, during the mining operations, that kind of throw history into a scatter during those moments.
It definitely is interesting. I tend to lean to the side of that there's definitely something down there. There's plenty of national parks that are enormous. You're allowed to walk through them all you want. There's really no restrictions to where you can and can't go. You might have park rangers that give you crap and say you can't go there, but there's not a lot of park rangers in some of these areas. They're so vast. For there to be so many stories about people going off the beaten path and then being confronted by somebody to say you have to turn back or that they're being observed from overhead. It's just weird that you would block off 90% of a park. There's so many people out there that are just adventurous and they're outdoorsmen and they just like to explore, and just to be restricted like that. And I get it. It's a canyon that's 6,000 feet deep at some points, and it's super dangerous and it's prone to flash flooding, but when has it ever stopped anyone? And why is it so restricted? It's not like it's a military base, or is it? I don't know. Maybe there's an underground military base there or something. But to me, it's something there that doesn't line up with the mainstream history narrative. And I'm inclined to believe, and I do believe, that there are definitely giants at some point in our history. I think they were pretty numerous. It's also interesting that a lot of the Native Americans share a lot of type tenets, like allegory, with the Egyptian culture. And you can see the pyramids in Egypt, and you can see that they're a little bit different, but they're pyramids in the United States, maybe not in the same form that they are in Egypt, but you see them in South America, like their step pyramids. It just points back to me that there was once a worldwide civilization that had very similar architecture styles. They varied because I think, again, pre-flood, there were a lot of people, a lot of giants, a lot of plays on how architecture should manifest, just a lot of cultures in general, even though I think everybody shared the same language. I think it's fascinating how everything interweaves together, but then the modern historical narrative is that somehow this all came up individually by itself. Each culture did these things without influence from any other culture. And it's just interesting that even these Native American tribes have these stories about the Star People, the Ant People. Like the Hopi have a myth about a great cataclysm, and these quote-unquote Ant People ushered them underground to escape this cataclysm. And a lot of them have these serpent rituals. A lot of them have the same symbolism with the snake eating its own tail. What are the odds, man? Like, you're separated by a massive ocean, thousands and thousands of miles of land, and you have the same motif being shared amongst just about every culture. You can even look at the Asian culture and draw inferences to the dragon, the snake, the phoenix. It's just wild, man. And I don't think it's not a big logical jump to suggest that at one point we all shared the same basic culture, same basic language, the same basic technology, but it just manifests in different ways. Just like if you go to Asia, like the architecture is different than it is here in the Western world, but it's still similar. Just the artistic presentation of it is different.
I think a lot about the time when we were kids visiting Mexico, and we went to the Mayan pyramid, and me and mom hiked up to the top of Chichen Itza, if I'm saying that name correctly. I think mom would probably tell the story way better than I can, because I think she was like kicking your ankle because you had hurt you sprained your ankle or something the night before. You couldn't hike up to the top of it. Lucky for me, I didn't, because I don't think you can actually climb that pyramid anymore. But it makes me think about it, because the Mayans existed just south of Arizona, where the Grand Canyon's located. One of the most powerful kind of native tribes within that region. And it just collapsed immediately. We knew that it spread across South America, across Mexico, likely into some parts of North America as well. And nobody knows why this civilization of millions upon millions of people just completely disappeared. But they knew there was some type of weird upheaval that occurred as well. But just bring it back to one of your points is, I can almost understand where the government's, we don't want you to go hiking down there because we don't have to come rescue you. Like, climbing down, why it's off limits. I get some of that because rescue operations are expensive, and if you get lost, people are going to feel obligated to get you. So I get that little kind of micro thing of it. But why can't people fly over the Grand Canyon? I find that one of the most fascinating things. So I did a little bit of research of this, and the canyon is covered by a patchwork of special flight rules, areas and zones where planes and helicopters have to follow strict routes, altitudes, and timings. But the reasons for these rules are neither what they say, exotic or unique. They just come down to two things, safety and sound, which sounds ridiculous to me. They're saying airplanes are going to cause too much noise over the Grand Canyon, and safety. They point back to a story in 1956. At that time, obviously, the air traffic control was primitive compared to what we have today. Two commercial planes, the TWA Super Constellation and a United DC-7, were both flying cross-country when they collided directly over the Grand Canyon. All 120 people on board were tragically killed. It was at this time the deadliest airline disaster in U.S. history. The wreckage still rests in remote corners of the canyon. And they say the crash was the turning point. Public outrage pushed Congress to overhaul the entire air traffic control system, and out of the tragedy grew the modern FAA and the national system of regulated skies we take for granted today. So when you hear about no-fly zones over Grand Canyon, what you're really hearing about is the regulations which were written to prevent another disaster. But we do have a very sophisticated FAA today. And those regulations still exist today where there are no fly zones over the Grand Canyon. Now, to me, that's don't fly over the Pacific because you might crash into the water, or don't fly into DC because a helicopter and an airplane collided together. It doesn't make a whole hell of a lot of sense to me. I think it adds a little bit of conspiracy to this story.
Yeah, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me, man. That almost seems like a really crappy excuse just not to have somebody fly over. You look at the airports, like you have dozens of planes flying within hundreds of meters of one another, taking off, landing. You're going to restrict an area just over the Grand. Why don't you just restrict all the airspace all over the whole world at that point? That seems like a pretty crappy excuse to, and unbelievable at that. Planes crash in the Alps. They crash in the forest of the freaking Amazon. You're never going to get that stuff. You're never going to recover that. But just sporadically, let's just pick the Grand Canyon. I think it's just because they don't want people taking pictures, man. I think there's, I have my opinion what I think it is, and we'll get to that. But that's, it's like saying you can't have your car key to drive your car. You can just look at it in the driveway.
It's super weird. Like, you can't fly over it. You can't walk where you want to walk. You can walk where we tell you to walk. I just find the whole thing strange. What it is, ultimately, I have my opinions, but It's strange.
They don't even let you fly drones. The drones are, what, a foot by foot if you're lucky? You can't fly a drone through the Grand Canyon. Why is that? Are you afraid it's going to crash into a helicopter or a jet plane? There's something they don't want you to see. Let's just give them the benefit of the doubt and say, we don't want you down there because it's too dangerous. We don't have to come rescue you. Fine. I want to fly my drone that maybe has, I don't know, let's just get an advanced drone that you or I could buy for 10 grand. And maybe it's the size of, I don't know, half the size of a car, a couple hundred pounds. Let me fly it 100 miles in. Why can't I do that and take pictures? It's just, there's something there they don't want you to see. And that's the only thing I can come up with.
Exactly. And when it comes to the Grand Canyon, it does have a darker known history as well. And it involves a lot of people vanishing there. Disappearance in the canyon, in my opinion, and what I read about are very real. Every year, visitors underestimate the terrain, the heat, the power of the river. Some cases have been solved with tragic endings and kind of others remain mysteries. Two of the most famous examples that I could find that kind of bookend nearly a century of speculation. And here's the first one. In 1928, newlyweds Glenn and Bessie Hyde set off down the Colorado River on their honeymoon adventure. Their boat was found floating intact. All their supplies that they brought with them were still on board, but Glenn and Bessie were gone. And to this date, their fate remains one of the canyon's most enduring mysteries because the boat was completely fine. They must have gotten off or gotten taken, but they were simply gone. Then we fast forward to 2015. Morgan Heimer, which is a young river guide at that time, was last seen near Pumpkin Springs during a commercial rafting trip. And he once again vanished. An intensive search with helicopters, ground crews, and river teams found absolutely nothing. And his case still remains open. Stories like these really feed the work of David Polidy, which is a former police officer turned into an author and filmmaker, created the Missing 411 series. I'm not sure if you heard about it, which argues that disappearance in the national parks across North America from these kind of disturbing patterns. David highlights strange circumstances, people vanishing within minutes, bodies found in hard to reach places, or these cases with eerie similarities. To his audience, the Grand Canyon became one of the very many hotspots of unexplained vanishing. But critics point out the problems. David rarely provides full case details and often leaves out very important facts about the law enforcement's kind of search and rescue teams that they put on record. But to me, there's a whole hell of a lot of people that has disappeared in the Grand Canyon. And to me, that kind of just adds to the conspiracy.
Sometimes I wonder if you're going down a river and you see a cave, and if what they say is true, these cave networks are large and vast, you have to be pretty intrepid to be going down on a raft in the middle of Grand Canyons. My assumption is that you have this high need to know, high need to explore. And sometimes I wonder, hey, if you or I are rafting down the Grand Canyon, we see a cave after all the podcasts we've done, I'd want to go and look. I'd want to explore. And if there's this huge, vast network of caves, if you get more than 100 feet or couple hundred yards in there, you may take a wrong turn and never find your way out, especially if you're not leaving some sort of trail behind you. And who knows what's in those caves? Could there be wild animals? Could there be methane gas pockets that you just go in there and you die from CO2 poisoning? Could there be, I still think there's giants. I don't think there's a ton of them, but they live underground. Who knows what's in there? It's scary to think about, and it makes you not want to go into a cave, that's for sure. But I tend to think that some of these missing cases are, the Grand Canyon is prone to flash floods, and they happen very quickly. That region is fairly arid, and when it rains, where's the water going? And it's going to find the lowest level to go to. So as it's coming over the cliffs, as it's pulling up in the water, I could see how you could get caught up in a mean rapid and get tossed overboard and sucked down the river. Some of these I think are pretty explainable, though weird, but I think if you think of it logically, there's a lot of just mundane things, not mundane, but a lot of easy explanations to account for some of these missing people. And I think going into a cave is probably the likely outcome of some of these cases, and they just can't find their way out.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I don't know if you ever went to it, the Mammoth Caves, which I think is in Kentucky, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And in my early 20s, I did some spelunking there. You could go on adventures and go explore around, which was very exciting. But the further, and they tell you that a lot of these caverns, like you could find a vein that nobody's ever discovered before because the the pathways are fast and just unknown, at least at that time. And the further I would go down there, the wetter it would obviously get. And at times, there sections of the cave would be flooded, so you'd have to find an alternative pathway. And the further I got down, man, my anxiety would just kick off and the walls would get very thin. I don't know if you've ever been in those caves where like you have to like shimmy through in order to get through the portals. I don't know how people do it, because I would go down there for 40, 50 minutes and I'm like, I'm ready to go back up to the top. I'm tired of squeezing through these rocks and getting claustrophobia.
Dude, I probably couldn't fit in half the holes, man. I'd be like, yo, yeah, that's all you, big dog. I'm not trying to squeeze through that.
The only way you can see is with a headlamp, and I'm like thinking of bugs and bats and everything else that could be crawling around there.
That's creepy. I like exploring, but I like to be able to move.
Exactly.
Dude, I gotta ask, what do you make of this? What do you make of the Grand Canyon? What do you think it is?
It's an interesting theory. I think when we stand at the edge of the Grand Canyon, we're ultimately looking at more than just layers of stone. I think we're looking at a witness to history. And for many Christians, myself included, that history is not millions of years of slow erosion, but the story told in Genesis, the account of Noah's flood. Scripture records a global cataclysmic event, which all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, waters covered the earth, reshaping the land in ways both dramatic and permanent. I think to believers, the Grand Canyon is one of the clearest testimonies to that event. Its sheer wall displays miles of stacked stone, which is sandstone, shale, limestone, laid down quickly by floodwaters that swept across all these continents. You know, what the things they found down there are marine fossils high on the canyon walls, which to me point to a time when the ocean covered the now dry Arizona desert. And the canyon itself, rather it being carved slowly by the Colorado River over millions of years, it's my belief it was cut rapidly as the floodwaters receded. Imagine the unimaginable force of water draining off the continent, rushing, scouring, slicing through the rocks. In that light, the Grand Canyon is not just a symbol of deep time, but of judgment, and also of God's power and mercy. For the flood narrative ends not in destruction, but in the covenant, the rainbow, the promise, and such judgments would never come again by way of water. I think looking through that biblical lens, it changes the canyon from this geological curiosity to a spiritual monument. It tells us that the Bible's history is reliable and that God's word explains the world we see today. And that canyon is not just a wonder of nature, but a reminder of God's sovereignty over creation and human history. Now, I think from a conspiracy standpoint, I'm of the opinion that there's probably some nephophilium activity that occurred there, is occurring there, or had occurred there, and it explains some of these artifacts. I think the Smithsonian is unreliable, and I think they're not telling us all the details that were uncovered. And instead of telling us facts, I think they're burying them under their own particular lens of the story that they want to tell, which is ultimately evolution and the Big Bang Theory and all these different things that they want to lead you astray and lead you to believe. I buy into this one a little bit. Don't buy into the UFO thing. I think that's a little bit hokey for me, but I do buy into the spiritual lens. And I wonder, and I'm of the opinion right now that it's one of the greatest artifacts where we can point to that says God created this world. And we have a lot of interesting facts that can point to that, whether it be the fall of man, the fall of angels through the nephophilium. Because if you look at the Grand Canyon, why are things of the sea being discovered in the walls? It just doesn't make a whole hell of a lot of sense why that would be there unless you follow the creation narrative. And as we went through it, and as you recounted, these tribes are talking about star people. They're talking about things they didn't quite understand. Perhaps they didn't get the word of God before they started to encounter it, but they're also talking about nephophilium. And so I think it's, and again, I look through the world through a biblical lens, but I buy into some of these details.
Yeah, man, I agree with you. I think a lot of people conflate alien technology with fallen angel technology that was given to us pre-flood. They are not the same. They're different in definition and in theory. I do believe that the Grand Canyon was carved out in a matter of days due to God's judgment. I don't think it took millions of years to do that. I actually watched an interesting documentary on Amazon, and there's plenty of geological evidence to suggest that it happened in a matter of days, weeks, and not in the matter of millennia. I'm under the impression. I'm just shooting from the hip here. I wonder, and this is just a part of my brain looking at it through, like you say, a biblical lens. I wonder at some point if the Nephilim and the fallen angels knew that the judgment was coming. I don't see how they wouldn't have known. I think there's plenty of apocryphal evidence through the book of Enoch that they knew that they were going to be judged and they knew that they were going to be wiped off the planet. If you ever get a chance to read the book of Enoch, it's a fascinating, in my opinion, pseudo-historical document. And they ask Enoch to talk to God and ask them to spare judgment and forgive them. And Enoch's like, yeah, I'll go ask. And essentially God said no. It's like, you try to corrupt my creation, tried to, and as you, all the Bible is foreshadowing to Jesus Christ, God's ultimate plan for forgiveness for the original sin. And I think Lucifer and the angels wanted to, they hate us so much that they wanted to pollute our gene pool so that Christ could never be born. Not that I think they knew it, but I think they just hated God and God's creation so much that they just didn't want it to exist. So they came up with this plan to essentially make it their own by injecting their own DNA or genetic code or whatever they have into us. And God's, nah, you think you're doing something wise and you think you're doing something sneaky? You don't even know the plan. So a part of me thinks that, and I've said this before on the show, and I do believe this, and again, it's not a matter of salvation. I do think that when the flood happened, it talks about the waters of the deep bursting forth. I do think the earth expanded. I don't think we had these massive oceans. I don't think we had the Pacific. I don't think we had the Atlantic. I think the earth was much smaller in circumference. And I'm under the belief, and I could have my opinion changed, that most of what the earth was landmass with lakes and rivers and all that. But you didn't have these vast oceans, so people could traverse the earth much quickly because it wasn't as large as it is now, at least in terms of its diameter and radius. But as the flood happened, it split apart, it grew larger, and that's where a bunch of these oceans came from. That's why I think that there's a lot of similar archaeology, a lot of similar stories and technology. But a part of me wonders, and I know I'm being a bit long-winded here, is if, I wonder if the Nephilim and the fallen angels thought they built underground cities that somehow they could ride out the flood. And I think it's interesting how the Grand Canyon was carved out so quickly. And I think it exposed parts of these underground cities that have these ancient ruins, these mummies, a lot of this proposed ancient technology. And God was like, nope, going to carve this out. Here's your stupid city. You guys are all dead. Now here's a testament to what you guys did and to what I can do. There's nothing you can do to override my grand plan to save the human race through my son. So I wonder if, I don't think, and I think as time progressed, people found these caves. Heck, people may have even deposited some of their artifacts from different parts of the world into them. And I wonder if that's what we're seeing.
Yeah, it reminds me is we're all trying to be kingmakers. And what I think the ultimate story of good versus evil is that we're trying to overcome God by replacing him, by being our own versions of God and controlling the narrative and controlling creation and controlling building. And you can never do that. Like, it's the greatest lie on earth. And as wise as they said the Nephilim were, because they brought down forbidden knowledge from heaven and led people astray, but they had advanced technology. But as wise as they were, they can't hide from God. And it's a good point. Perhaps they were building these underground cities and they were trying to find a way to seal it off and protect themselves from the floodwaters. Maybe. But they saw what making kings were. They failed. And if they're still around today, don't know. I know the devil's prowling, but I don't know if these particular burritos are around. They will learn it again in the long run. But what do you want to leave our audience with today?
Man, same thing I do every week. I don't think that will ever change. Maybe it will. Jesus loves you. We love you. I love you, brother. And the most important thing, man, is study the Word of God. Ask for wisdom and discernment. I think if you look at history enough, you'll see so many puzzle pieces that fit together, and it points back to a lot of the stuff that we see today. A lot of the congruencies between cultures, they all kind of point back to one that existed pre-flood. And I'm just going to say, I know it existed pre-flood when Noah and his family got off the ark. They obviously knew the histories. They obviously knew the stories, though Noah may have carried the flag to what we are today. I think his sons and their wives fell back into the old ways and took up the old cultures and spread the old stories. And that really just re-expanded back all over the world. And I think a lot of the stuff that we see with the Egyptians, I think that was the pyramids with some of the markings on the walls, some of that technology that I think exists. I think a lot of that was just a reinterpretation or a people just taking on that guise because that's what they knew and that's what they started to present themselves with again.
I think in closing, it reminds me of a story. They say the devil wept when Jesus was crucified. Not because he cared about Jesus, because quite frankly, he probably didn't, because he knew he was doomed. Have discernment, question everything, and have understanding. Everything that the government's telling you, everything that museums are telling you, the narrative that they are feeding you ain't always accurate. So lead with discernment. Until next time, like, subscribe, follow, reach out on our social medias. And until then, we're Zero Signal.
I just want to say one thing. I think when Jesus was crucified, the devil thought he won. I think the devil wept when Jesus came back to life because I don't think they were expecting that. I think that was when they knew they were screwed, bro. That's when they knew. They thought they won. Then Jesus came back and they were like, I had no idea. But anyway, with that said, you guys have a great night.
We've hit the 0 hour. That's a wrap on this week's transmission. New episodes drop weekly, so stay tuned and don't miss the next signal. Follow, subscribe, and spread the word. You've been listening to Zero Signal. We're out.
This episode is brought to you by Prep Starts Now, because life doesn't come with a warning. When an emergency strikes, whether it's a power outage, natural disaster, or even a medical scare, the last thing you want is panic. Prep Start Now empowers families to be ready with the right tools, knowledge, and confidence. They're about smart planning so you can focus on protecting your family instead of scrambling for solutions. Their shop has everything from first aid kits and water filtration to backup power and essential gear. Plus, their Prep Academy makes it easy to learn emergency skills with simple guides and quick tips anyone can follow. I've arranged an exclusive 15% discount for my listeners. Just go to prepstartsnow.com and use promo code ZEROSIGNAL at checkout, or click the link in my show notes where the discount is applied automatically. Don't wait for the next crisis. Take action today. That's prepstartsnow.com. Promo code ZEROSIGNAL.